Welcome, everyone. This is the sixth and final office hours session for the Mises Academy online class, Basics of Economics, Government Intervention. And we are off to the races because Don already has a question. So as always, those of you who have trickled in here, please post your questions. Don says, have any Austrians graphed the money supply over time and superimposed it on a timeline of boom and bust cycles? I don't know about that in particular, Don. What I do know is, all right, let me say two things at least. There was a guy at NYU, well, there were two guys, one of them was me. There was a guy at NYU who did his, I think it was his dissertation on an empirical test of Hayekian business cycle theory, but I can remember being in the library looking for it. I don't remember if I ever actually got my hands on it and read it. I think I probably got it and just cited it, but I didn't like read the thing cover to cover. But so there is that. Unfortunately, off the top of my head, I can't remember if you did exactly what you're asking. What I did, there's a few things. We had to do an, it was for our econometrics class at NYU, macro econometrics class, combining my least two favorite subjects. And we had to, you had to do a paper. You know, it wasn't like you had to get published or something, but it was for the class. That's one of the things you had to do. And so I thought, well, geez, they're going to make me do some sort of statistical analysis of macro level data. Let me go test Austrian business cycle theory. And so I think we used the Gauss software. I can't remember off the top of my head. And anyway, for what it's worth, it worked. Like it came out, and yep, Hayek's right. I did something like I separated. What did I do? I looked at like the industry or the sector classifications, the way the government compiles that stuff, and I came up with a way of saying, okay, how far away are they from consumption? I did something like that. So, you know, in the canonical Hayekian triangle kind of version, or I should say the way Roger Garrison does it, he's got the Hayekian triangle and the thing farthest from consumption is like mining. And then there's like processing and manufacturing and distribution and retail and consumption, right? So he's got things separated into those kind of stages. So mining of iron ore and stuff like that, that's really far removed from consumption. So those are very roundabout processes, whereas the grocery store buying milk from the dairy farm and then having it, you know, putting it in their cooler so then a consumer can come by 24 hours later and put it in their cart and go buy it, that's pretty close to consumption. So that's not a very roundabout process, that particular activity, right? So in standard Hayekian Austrian business cycle theory, when interest rates get pushed artificially low, it's not just that it stimulates overall investment, it's that it particularly stimulates the longer term projects, so the things more removed from consumption. So it would provide more of a stimulus to like mining operations as opposed to a grocery store if interest rates drop. So that's what I tried to measure and see, you know, so I did whatever the heck you do with getting the series going back as far as they had it of short and medium term treasury rates and then whatever the breakdown was of it. I don't know if it was industry or sector classifications or whatever I used. And anyway, did that and it popped out. Yep, it works. It's whatever, you know, I can reject the null hypothesis. The null hypothesis would have been that the interest rate, that every sector is equally sensitive to the interest rate. And so, like, if interest rates drop, it's just that spending and investment go up in general, not that they go up in particular sectors or industries. And I was able to reject that null hypothesis. But the thing is, it didn't bolster my confidence in it, because if it turned out the other way, I wouldn't have believed it. So, I got to be consistent. If it had apparently rejected Austrian business cycle theory, I still would have believed it. So I said, well, I can't therefore have more confidence in Austrian business cycle theory just because these coefficients or whatever that it spits out at the end are statistically significant. But more relevant to your question, Don, what I have done is, and not in like peer-reviewed literature, but just like stuff that I've done for a PowerPoint to talk to an audience, or I think I probably published it on Mises.org articles over the years. You can definitely, no, actually I did it for a bank client too, now that I'm thinking about it. All right, so I was pretty careful about it to make sure I had dotted my I's and crossed my T's. But you can, what I did do was chart movements or the level of interest rates. I think it was the effective, the price inflation adjusted or the real effective federal funds rate, and then look at changes in GDP over time. And that looks pretty good. It's what you would want if you want the Austrian story to be right, that when they jack up the interest rate, the economy crashes, and then when they push down the interest rate, the economy starts surging. And then you can also say, okay, well, is that just the Fed passively responding to changes in the market, or is the Fed somehow causing those changes? And then there you can look at charts of money supply growth, like I think it was monetary base that I looked at. And that also does look like what you want, so that in periods when interest rates are falling, the growth rate in the quantity of the monetary base is higher. And then in periods when the interest rate is rising, it's not that the quantity of money shrinks, but the rate of growth slows. Right? So that's, and that generally holds over decades if you plot that stuff. So I don't think I ever did money supply and boom bust cycles, but I broke it up into two different things. I did money supply and interest rates, make it to show that it looks like the Fed is or does have some control over the movement of interest rates, or at least short-term interest rates. And then I've done interest rates with boom bust cycles. Okay, while you guys are thinking, let me see, Don, if you want, I don't want to take time to do it right this second, Don, but let me make a note to myself. I wonder if I type it in here. I wonder if I'm going to remember. No, find charts. That's not showing up. Okay, hopefully it will jog my memory. Because what I got to do now when these classes are over, I go back and see if there's any pending questions that I forgot to answer or ran out of time. So hopefully I'll see this and then post that in the catch-all thing, and I'll show you if they're online somewhere. I think they are, and I'll show you exactly what I'm talking about. Okay, while you guys are thinking of other questions, let me mention something. As you may know, if you follow my blog, I have a bee in my bonnet lately about this Thomas Piketty guy, author of the best-selling Capital in the 21st Century. And just so you know, it's when I went into it, it's not like I had an axe to grind. I was perhaps a little bit jealous that, geez, who's this guy? Nobody ever heard of before. Now he's all of a sudden got the best-selling book on Amazon. And so, of course, you got to be careful. If you go and you'll have a chip on your shoulder and say, oh, I'm going to convince myself this guy's a punk. But just the more I read of the book, the more astonished I was at how awful it was. And I've told you guys that before. But lately, now, the thing that's making my jaw drop even more, such that I need to be like one of those pythons or something and be able to disattach it from the hinges, is the way he and other and his fans have been responding to the criticism. So in this course, I think it was last week, maybe 2 weeks ago, I'm getting mixed up at this point. But anyway, Chris Giles in the Financial Times of the FT published a critique. Yeah, it was right before Memorial Day weekend. On a Friday, it came out alleging that Piketty's what happened is that the problem is there's no single series looking at capital ownership by rankings or, you know, by concentration. So to say, like, the wealthiest 1% of Americans or of people in Great Britain or of people in France, what percentage of total wealth did they own over long stretches of time? There's no single studies that can do that. And part of the reason is the type of source documents you have to work with change over time, right? So there's no consistent, like, government didn't have estate tax data going back to 1800 that's consistently compiled and so that you can be comparing apples and apples. All right, so what Piketty did then is he went out and looked at the literature and what was available. And so you had a bunch of different studies for certain periods. And then he wanted to string them all together so that they would overlap, right? So that he could publish in his book charts going back, you know, going from like 1810 to the present to talk about these century-long trends and concentration of wealth and the source of that wealth, like did or the income. So like, is the income coming primarily from capital assets, or is it coming from highly skilled laborers, which could include like hedge fund managers? Okay, so that's the kind of stuff he's doing. So this guy Giles was, let me back up. So most people, including myself, just assumed that Piketty's work in this respect was fine. You know, we obviously can always quibble about stuff, but we figured, okay, we're not going to get in there and challenge this guy who is, by all accounts, a pioneer in this particular area of the literature of publishing peer-reviewed articles on historical data series of wealth concentration. Like, that's Piketty's area. That's one of the areas, and that's like where Larry Summers, in what was arguably a negative review of the book, said Piketty should get a it wouldn't be wrong for Piketty to get a Nobel Prize for his empirical work, just documenting the historical trends. Okay, so most people just, including me, including Peter Klein, you know, we didn't even bother going down there. We just said, look, let's stipulate for the sake of argument that he's right. Does it follow that we should tax the heck out of rich people, blah, blah, blah. We went into that stuff. Or we talked about how Piketty doesn't understand what generates interest, because he relies on a crude productivity theory. And the Austrians in particular are good about why that's nonsense. So that's the kind of stuff we're focused on. Then this guy Chris Giles comes along in the FT and says, I was just looking at some of this stuff and I noticed there's huge discrepancies between the official Office of National Statistics survey data on wealth concentration in the UK compared to what Piketty is reporting in his book. It's a difference of, 25 percentage points, humongous, referring to the wealth owned by the top 10%. And so that made him start looking into it, because up till then, even Piketty's critics just gave him a pass on the empirical work and assumed that was fine. So they go into it and Piketty put his Excel files, they're publicly available, so you can see like what the original data sources were and then how he used Excel formulas to like average them or, you know, adjust them and do things like that. And so Giles just is listing all of these complaints, ranging from things like saying it looks like Piketty just literally typed in the wrong numbers here. Like, you can see the source and you can see what he typed in his Excel column and the numbers are different. To more serious allegations and so on. Okay. So it's in the fallout to that criticism that, again, my jaw is just, one of the things that people have done, including Piketty and Krugman and others, is to say, look at this guy, Chris Giles, he reconstructs, you know, in other words, uses the same data set that Piketty had available to him and that Piketty uses in his book. And Giles says, whoa, whoa, whoa. If you look at any one of these sources, none of them shows this huge surge up in inequality that Piketty puts in his book. Okay, so think about that. Piketty is, he has like 15 different data sources covering different periods, and he's going to string them all together, and he has to make adjustments to account for the fact that they use different methodology and stuff like that. And in the result, the composite that Piketty shows makes it look like income inequality and capital inequality, the ownership of wealth since the 70s, has surged upward dramatically. But Giles pointed out, wait a minute, I actually went and checked his Excel tables, and if you look at any one of the data sources upon or from which Piketty's drawing, none of them shows such an upswing. So they all have different levels, because they all measure different things and they have different possible biases and stuff. But the point is, looking at any one of them, you don't see this upward trend. So Piketty has to pick and choose and then use his adjustments and turn them into apples to apples in such a way that he gets this thing that is not in any of the original data sources. Okay, so that's a pretty serious allegation. It's claiming that Piketty, either honestly or otherwise, is inventing this spurious upward surge in income, or it's not income inequality, in capital wealth inequality that's not there, that he's just imposing it on the data by the way he picks and chooses and blends the figures together. Okay, so one of the chief responses by Piketty and Krugman and all his fans is to say, well, look it, yeah, we can quibble over the specific things Piketty did in his Excel table, but we have this new paper by Emmanuel Saez and a co-author, Zuckman, I may be mispronouncing their name, that came out in March of 2014. Look at these results. And they, you know, give a hyperlink to it, and they show a nice table showing that, you know, they use a new methodology. By the way, it's a new method, but everyone says methodology to some fancy. The proper term here would be method. It's a new method, and it shows that the 0.1% of wealth owners in the U.S., their holdings since the 70s has like tripled. And it's, you know, and it's now back to where it was like in the early 1900s. And so they're saying, see, whatever Piketty did, and you can quibble with it, his story is correct, because this new blockbuster paper that uses the best methodology in the empirical literature that corrects for some of the biases and earlier published results is showing actually more capital inequality, ownership inequality, wealth inequality than even what Piketty put in his book. So Piketty actually was understating how bad things are. Right? And so that has been the ultimate trump card that you guys have all been using to say, whatever you want to say about the process by which he got his answer, the answer is correct. All right, so what I just learned today, again, you just assume these guys aren't shysters because you got to pick and choose your battle. What I just learned today is I never bothered to actually click the link and go see what these guys are talking about. This new paper, it's not even a paper. It's not even a working paper. It's a PowerPoint presentation. That's what everyone's linking to prove that Piketty is right, is that these guys who posted a PowerPoint presentation showing their preliminary results found something that's more significant than Piketty. And I have this on my blog now. Here, I'll post a link just in case anybody cares, and then I'll turn to your guys' questions. Don't worry, this bee is out of my bonnet at this point, but I had to vent. Just pulling it up here. Okay, so here it is, in case you guys care. There's the link where I lay all this stuff out. But, so this guy Saez, and again, I might be mispronouncing his name, in his 2014 PowerPoint PDF that's floating around, where, you know, you don't see his actual data sets or what he did, he just talks about his method and then post the results. If you take that and compare it to Sayaz's own 2004 paper and compare them, they're pretty, and look at the top 0.1% of wealth ownership, they're very similar, like with plus or minus 1 or 2 percentage points for most of the years from 1916, which is when the later one starts, all the way up through the mid-1980s. They move in tandem. Like if you superimposed them, they would be remarkably close. So they're clearly both good ways of measuring the same thing. Like maybe their levels are off, but the point is they move together very closely. Don't misunderstand me. When I say their levels are off, I mean relative to what the truth is. Compared to each other, the levels are remarkably similar. Okay, so I'm not just saying they have the same shape, but one is like a slide. No, they almost overlap perfectly if you superimpose them. From 1916 up until the mid-1980s, they move very similarly. But then, from the 1980s on to the year 2000, the 2004 paper is flat and shows no increase in wealth inequality from the mid-1980s until the year 2000, whereas this new 2014 PowerPoint slide shows it doubling in that period, and then it keeps zooming up after 2000, because the 2004 paper stops in 2000. Right, so that the point is, that's the trump card people are using, is a PowerPoint slide that wildly diverges right where the argument is from previous results by the same guy that matched up to them. You know, and so the point is, yeah, you can argue that the 2004 paper used a weaker method or an unsatisfactory method, and that the new paper's method is better, and so its results should be more, you know, we should have more confidence in them. But why then did the two match almost perfectly from 1916 up to the mid-1980s, and then they started diverging radically? That's the thing. So anyway, it's, again, no matter how much I think, okay, I've now got my arms around just what a bunch of shysters these guys are, they do something like that. And the thing is, it's not even, just so you know, it's not even that I think Paul Krugman's up at night going, and he's blogging thinking, haha, here I'm a liar. It's just they are so sure they're right that they will throw anything out, you know, any result that looks like it fits what they think is right. Well, clearly that's a good argument. They post it. Whereas if something shows up that contradicts what they say, well, that must be wrong because they know what the truth is. And so then they, you know, Krugman's a smart guy. He can find some reason that particular thing. Like Krugman, that Giles guy, his data points that were way different from what Piketty was showing, it was survey data. You know, it wasn't tax return stuff. It was his data with the British government or their Office of National Statistics, I guess, was just interviewing people. And so Krugman said, well, you can't trust that because it's hard to track down billionaires and ask them questions about how much they own. Okay. But then one of Krugman's points about why, come on, these guys challenging Piketty's basic results can't be right because we've got the Forbes rankings, you know, the wealthiest 400 Americans, that kind of stuff. Well, that's a survey too. That's asking billionaires how much they have. So asking billionaires how much they have, if it shows Piketty is wrong, Krugman, can't trust that. What the heck are you talking about? Whereas if it shows Piketty is right, well, there you go. How can anyone argue with this? So there's a bunch of inequality deniers. Okay. I've got that out of my system unless you guys are asking follow-ups. Okay, Jed says, I didn't get a chance to reread your response to Krugman's we owe it to ourselves defensive budget deficits before posting this or posing this question. But didn't you assume in your example that the bondholders who were paid off at the end of the 100-year period had purchased the bond at the beginning of the period? I'm sure your argument does not assume the bondholders are all over 100 years old, so what am I missing? Okay, so yeah, my argument doesn't assume that, if that relieves you. And in fact, I think my argument would break down. Like my argument is, and here, when I say my argument, I'm just trying to crystallize what James Buchanan and Nick Rohl were talking about. And again, just to say this, I sort of rushed through it in the main lecture. Ludwig von Mises and Human Action made perfectly true statements about all this stuff. You never saw him quite get into the fine details about the fact that there's different generations coming and dying and that, you know, these particular nuances that I'm bringing up here. But it's not that Mises ever said anything wrong. He knew that Abel Lerner and these guys who were saying it's not a burden because we owe it to ourselves, that was nonsense. Okay, so just keep that stuff in mind. But on the particular point here, Jed, I haven't reread the article in a while myself, so I don't want to talk definitively about what I might have said in that particular article. But no, it wouldn't have assumed people were more than 100 years old. So here's how it works. You have, just in general, to see the problem, just imagine there's three generations. Okay, and in the beginning, but only two of them are alive in the beginning. So we're going to have like the really old people, the middle-aged workers, and then who are all alive today, and they're going to make a decision. And then 100 years from now, you're going to have the young workers who literally weren't even alive today. Okay, and so what you can imagine is that today the old people are going to get a bunch of goodies from the government, like extra Social Security benefits or Medicare or whatever. Okay, and how is the government? And the government's not going to tax anybody to pay for it. Instead, the government is going to issue bonds and borrow it from today's workers. Okay, so today's workers, it's like a wash, okay? Well, it's not a wash. Their consumption goes down so that the older people today can consume more. So that's physically how it's possible. Because with this stuff, the trick is, and the reason Krugman and Dean Baker and Abel Lerner, the reason there's a superficial appeal to what they're saying and why even I didn't quite see what was going on, is you want to say, if people today, if older people are consuming more, if we want to argue at the expense of our unborn grandkids, it's not like there's a time machine. It's not like they're literally somehow sucking consumption out of the future and enjoying it today. It has to be through mechanisms today. So one mechanism is that if we just save less, if there's less capital accumulation, if resources are diverted into giving goodies to old people today instead of being used to build machines and tools and equipment, well, that's one obvious way. That means we're bequeathing fewer tools to our grandkids who aren't born yet. But there's something else entirely, and I apologize. I realize there's 19 things going on here, and that's why it's so complicated. But the point is, there's something even more subtle. It's not merely so. The way a government budget deficit today can, in a very legitimate sense, impoverish unborn generations. It's not merely that if the government borrows a bunch of money today, it drives up interest rates and causes less private sector investment. That is one mechanism, and that's an important one. But even put that aside, forget that. That's not even the whole story, that's just one possible way. The other way that Krugman and Dean Baker totally miss is that, okay, the people alive today, the workers today, they invest. You know, they see the government offering bonds. It's 5% or whatever, and they say, oh, okay, that should be a good investment. So they do that. So their consumption goes down, and what do they acquire? They acquire government IOUs. That's what they invested in. Okay. Now, but assume the amount of physical machinery and that kind of stuff is the same. So there's no crowding out. It's just that today's workers, who otherwise would have consumed a lot, instead they say, no, we won't consume that. We'll just acquire extra assets, namely government IOUs. and the old people then consume what the younger workers would have otherwise done. Okay, so imagine total consumption and total private investment are the same. It's just a rearrangement. Okay, so the grandkids who will get born in the future have the same amount of tools and everything to work with. So guys like Krugman and Dean Baker are going to say, well, clearly they have to be indifferent to this. Like, it's just a wash. It's just a distributional issue. If they had the same amount of tools and machinery, then we know actual production, when they go to work and use those tools and machinery and factories, total GDP is the same as it otherwise would have been. So how can they be made poor? It's not like they're going to create a car, it's going to come off the assembly line, and it's going to disappear because it went in a time machine 100 years ago. That's not going to happen. Anything that they produce is going to be available at that moment. And so if the government now says, oh, wait a minute, we have this huge debt that we inherited, so we're going to have to tax some of you in order to pay the bondholders, Krugman and those guys say, yeah. So they're just taking money from one group of grandkids and giving it to somebody else. It's a big deal. But watch, here's what the big deal is. Before that happens, the people owning the bonds who initially lent the money to the government, now they become old, like halfway through this period. So let's say when they're 65 or 70, and the grandkids get born, and they're working, and now you want to get the bonds into the hands of the grandkids. And so how does that happen? Well, it's not that the grandparents, or it's not that the parents now, talking to their kids, just give it to them. They sell them, right? And so, because if you're retired, imagine that you were working originally and you lent a bunch of money to the government to get bonds. Why'd you do that? You were planning for your retirement. You said, oh, when I turn 65, I want to start drawing down these assets that I've accumulated. And so if people start doing that, that's how they finance their retirement. Okay, so what ends up happening is the grandkids who weren't even alive when the original decisions were made, they end up, yes, getting ownership of those treasury bonds, such that if the government just decides now, 100 years later, boom, a one-time fell swoop operation to tax a bunch of taxpayers and then pay off the bondholders, so it looks like it's just a transfer. And you would think, well, how can just a transfer do anything to those people collectively? It just takes from some and gives to the other. What's the big deal? It's because the people who then are getting paid that principal and interest to retire the government bonds, they weren't handed those bonds for free. When they were younger, years early, young workers, the way they got those bonds was by reducing their consumption. And that's how they got the bonds in the first place, that held them for a little bit longer and then got the lump sum payoff from the government. So if you're looking at it that way, you see various groups are benefited and hurt by this. Up front, clearly the very old people who get the goodies up front, they clearly benefit. But also the people who lent to the government voluntarily, they benefit. They get a nice rate of return on a safe asset from their micro perspective. And so, they think of it as they weren't forced to take those government bonds. They did that voluntarily. So as long as the government doesn't default, they benefit as well. It's true, they lowered their consumption up front, and that made it physically possible for the old people to raise their consumption. But looking over their whole lifetime, they benefited because they lowered their consumption when they were young workers or middle-aged workers, and then they had a higher consumption in their retirement years. And so how was that physically possible? It's because the workers, those guys were retiring in the middle period, those workers coming on the scene themselves reduced their consumption in order to get the bonds. But they weren't newly issued bonds. They were just the bonds that had been issued decades earlier, and they were just acquiring them. But how did they acquire them? They had to get consumption to the people who were now retired. Okay, so that's what's going on. So those grandkids now, when you look at them collectively, they reduce their consumption to get a bunch of bonds, and then to get paid off, they just like grab money from each other. And like it was just the government grabbing money from the pockets of some to hand to others. But collectively, they're all poorer because they had to get the bonds by lowering their consumption. And then to be made whole, they just taxed each other. And so, yeah, on that, some of them might have gained and some of them, but others must have lost. But as a whole, collectively, they're all clearly worse off on average because they got these pieces of paper by giving up consumption. And then, yeah, it's true, the owners of those pieces of paper got a nice lump sum payment from the government, but that came from somebody else who's alive at that moment. So if you look at it in terms of the generations, the very old people initially clearly benefit, the middle generation clearly benefits, and the third generation, who wasn't even alive when the decisions were set in motion, clearly gets screwed. Okay, so it's a tricky thing because you kind of need to have, strictly speaking, what you need to have is like four time periods where they each generation overlaps once. And that's the way to think it through. That's the simplest way to think of it where you can still get this result. Okay, so the reason Krugman and Dean Baker were not able to get this result is because their model wasn't that complicated. They were only thinking of it as one generation at a time, like per time period. They're thinking, oh, today we got our people, our generation. 50 years from now, we'll have the next generation. 50 years, then we'll have the third generation. And that's not, if you do think of it like that, then you can't get it to work. You can't see this possibility. The way you can see this possibility is that the different generations who each overlap a little bit on the front end and the back end. And if you allow that, which of course is realistic, more realistic, then you can get this result. All right, so probably Jed, you're even more confused now, but let me know if you want me to say anything more on that. Okay, Don says, would you consider teaching a course tying Austrian economics to financial markets economics? I'm thinking about bridging theory and reality. David Stockman does that in his book, but he assumes the reader understands financial jargon. Yeah, I agree with you, Don, that this is a great area. And in fact, when I talk to people who are interested in Austrian economics and they're going into grad school and they're asking me for advice about what do I do my dissertation on, I point them in this direction for two reasons. Say, first of all, it's inherently interesting, and that's a great way in terms of the advancement of Austrian theory, but also it's pretty safe in terms of your career that it's very marketable. If you do a dissertation that's of relevance to the financial sector that uses Austrian stuff, that's much more marketable than if you do like a history of economic thought on Karl Menger or something like that. So that's, or, you know, just doing a more straight business cycle paper that's more academic, then you're going to get into all kinds of issues about, oh, what about rational expectations? What about this and what about that? And it's going to be harder for you as an Austrian, whereas the financial sector, even the academic, the pure theory of that stuff is a lot more friendly to Austrian economics because they don't assume, how can I put it? The theoretical results for things like option pricing and just in general, those kinds of techniques, the way they get those things, like they assume no arbitrage and then they come up with results and, well, you know, put call parity and blah, 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 and those kind of neat little results they get for how would a market in principle correctly price derivatives. That kind of stuff, it's much more friendly to Austrian economics than like Keynesian economics is. And so it's still very mathematical, obviously, but they don't assume a lot of the things about a stationary economy and stuff like that. It's just more of the only assumptions they really make are that there's no pure profit opportunity. And they say, given that, what can we say about what these various asset prices have to be in order that a speculator couldn't just come in and look at them and realize there's a pretty much pure profit opportunity? All right, so that's a much weaker condition rather than a lot of the stuff that's in mainstream macro, like rational expectations and stuff like that. So, so Don, I definitely agree. That's something that Austrians should go into. And also, I found as an Austrian economist, it's hard for me to talk to other professional economists because they think we're all obsolete and, you know, they like their cutting edge tools that don't work. And they think we're just verbal economists living in the past. We're dinosaurs. But I can certainly talk to people who are actually in the financial sector. And I start giving a presentation on the housing bubble, and those guys and gals, a lot of them are very receptive, and they know that, okay, this guy, what he's saying at least makes sense, and maybe he's right, whereas they'll watch somebody like Paul Krugman and just say, this guy is so out of touch that he doesn't have the first inkling of knowing what's going on in the actual financial markets. So I agree that would be good. As far as would I teach a class on that, I'll think about it. It's tricky though, Don, because it's I could certainly do a lecture or two of the things that I've gone through, but going beyond that, it's hard because it's not actually mine. Well, it depends what we talk about. Anyway, I'll think about it. Other questions from you guys? Incidentally, Don, just remember, if you like David Stockman, we're bringing him in, and there's an addition of Tom Woods and Larry Reed, who's the president of FEE, and this guy Nelson Nash, who wrote a book on insurance and how that relates to Austrian economics and household planning. We're bringing them into Nashville on August 15th. Night of Clarity is the website, if you're interested. But David Stockman is the headliner. Okay, Jed says, in the same vein of Don's question, do you have any other classes you plan to teach for Mises Academy? Not right now, and I think they're reorganizing the structure, so I have to wait for that to shake out. I think they might be changing. I don't know. To answer your question. So I think I got to wait. And then what happens is if I have an idea, I run up the flagpole and see if people could be, they got to make sure that they don't have two people teaching a very similar class right next to each other, that kind of stuff. So the quick answer is no, there are no immediate plans, but I'm always open to suggestions. Any other questions you guys got? Okay, Don says, will old series at Mises Academy be available for viewing at any point at a discount? I could be mistaken, Don, but I think that already is available. I mean, I know for sure, at least at one point, I don't know if it's still true, but people were able to buy access to previous classes that I taught, you know, so not, they were no longer live, but they were able to get access to earlier stuff. So, I see what you're saying. You think some are, but not most. Okay. I don't know, Don, that's not something that I handle. Daniel Sanchez is the guy who knows that. If you email him and ask him what to do, it could be that it's a pain to make them available in that format, and so they only are doing them piecemeal, or maybe they're doing it like as a commercial. I have no idea. I'm just making stuff up, Don. I don't know. But Dan Sanchez would know, so if you email him, he can tell you exactly what the deal is, and also like if they have plans on making more stuff available. Okay, Joe asks, a lecturer at Mises U 2013 mentions that Austrian economics should not totally disregard game theory. Do you think it worthwhile to read von Neumann's book? I do know calculus, by the way, so that would not be a problem for me. Okay, that's a good question. So for people who don't know, game, you've probably heard the term game theory. It does involve the formal study of games, but really what it is in its purest form is the formal study of strategic interactions. And so specifically in game theory, what we do is you figure out who all the players are, or you can call them agents if you want to sound snootier. And then you figure out what the strategy space is for each player. Okay, so the possible strategies each person could adopt. And then you have to have a payoff function that says, okay, for any possible profile of particular strategies adopted by each player, then this payoff function points to and says, okay, for this particular sequence of player strategies, these are the payoffs for every player. All right, and so if you got that stuff, then you got your game, and then you can go do things like compute equilibria and stuff like that. So like a Nash equilibrium, after John Nash, is a profile of specific strategies such that for every particular player's strategy that's in the profile, given that all the other players' strategies is fixed, or are fixed, that particular strategy is a best response. Okay, so that's why it's an equilibrium. So in other words, if the players ever all expected that everybody else was gonna play the strategy that's in this Nash equilibrium, you would be willing to play the strategy that the Nash equilibrium has you doing. And since that's true for everybody, this is a plausible outcome. It's a stable outcome. This could be a self-fulfilling prophecy. You would have no reason to deviate from that particular strategy. Okay, so that's, and then you can go through and talk about stuff like that. This guy, von Neumann, he was a polymath. And he dabbled in all kinds. He was a great mathematician. I think he had a lot of early contributions to what would become computer science. And one of his, he also had with Oscar Morgenstern, who was an Austrian economist, Morgenstern was. So von Neumann and Morgenstern had an early publication on the theory of games. And they analyzed in particular, I think they just looked at two-person zero-sum games. So a zero-sum game means that if one person's gain is another person's loss, so that the total sum is zero in terms of the payouts. So that includes a lot of the games that you're familiar with, you know, chess and checkers and things like that. There's a winner and a loser, or there could be a tie in some games. So those are zero-sum games. Okay, and so then John Nash generalized. You know, he published results that were more general than just the specific thing. So von Neumann and Morgenstern came up with some particular results, you know, statements you could make about a whole class of zero-sum games. You know, assume certain conditions, and then boom, look at these results. So anyway, Joe, let me send you two links here, and you can read those and decide if you want to go into it. At NYU, my field was actually, it was called theory, but what it was game theory. Because just so you guys know, in formal economics that you would get at like a top 10 school, the game theorists are the most anal. Like they're the ones where, like, you know, you gotta learn the notation very carefully. You get really specific about what's the strategy space, and you got to specify that. Then you got to make sure your dimensions are correct. And so it was kind of like, whereas the macro guys are just all over the place and just by the seat of their pants, and the econometrics was the worst of both worlds, where it looked like they were being really rigorous, but they didn't know what the hell they were doing. Of course, I'm generalizing. Okay, so anyway, the reason I went into game theory was I was saying, okay, well, we're going to use mathematical models to explain people's behavior, to describe people's behavior and how they interact with each other. And we're going to study equilibrium conditions and that kind of stuff. Let's not do it half-heartedly. Let's just hardcore. Let's push this to the limit. And that's what game theory does. Okay, so game theory, if you will, is like mathematical economics in its purest form. So that's why I liked it, because it was extremely rigorous and it made sense, because you were looking at it. It was a very micro-based approach. You were looking at everything from the individual player's perspective, what his payoff function was or his preferences, if you want to think of it like their utility function. And you knew exactly the structure of the game, very well defined. And like I said, the people publishing in this area were incredibly anal. And so they were very careful that you knew exactly where they were coming from and everything made sense. Some of the results were nutty and defied common sense, but you could understand exactly how they got where, like I said, with macro, they would just make up, like the models weren't even internally consistent. It was like, oh, let's assume people are holding money because we have to have the central bank make policy regarding money. But in the world of the model, nobody would need to hold money. So let's just put it in the utility function. So if they're holding money, just like you might want to hold a Picasso painting, you know, so it's just, anyway, I'm rambling. But, so Joe, I wrote to Mises.org articles on this. So let's see. It's called The Games Economists Play. Let's see. Yeah, there it is. Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to send you this one link, and for people who are hearing this and want to go find it. The name of the article is The Games Economists Play, but then in the first sentence, there's a hyperlink, and I say in a previous article, and you can also click that, and you actually should click that, because that previous article is more basic. And then, so those two, you can see, as an Austrian, I am explaining game theory. So if you're, it's not so much calculus, Joe. I mean, it kind of is, but it's more like it's fixed point theorems, if you know what that stuff is. Like that's the way John Nash gets his existence results. So he'll say, given a game and given certain conditions like continuity and things on the payout functions, I can prove that a Nash equilibrium exists. And he didn't call it a Nash equilibrium, that's what we call it now. All right, so that's the kind of thing you want to be able to prove for general games of this class. Do we know that an equilibrium is going to exist? And he proved that, yeah, so it's a fixed point theorem, because it's saying you want, is everybody, given what everybody else is doing, is there a best response? And so then you're checking, is the profile of strategies a fixed point theorem when you run it through the best response on a function with correspondence. So anyway, there's some neat stuff. Also, this comes up in utility theory. And you might have seen this because David Friedman brings this up a lot. So the standard Austrian position is to say utility is ordinal, not cardinal. And what ordinal means is a ranking, you know, first, second, third, those are ordinal numbers, 48th. Whereas cardinal numbers are specific magnitudes, like 1.7 and 3.8. So to see the difference, 4 is bigger than 2. And second place is better than fourth place. So you can see the the rankings and the relative relationships between it with either ordinal or cardinal. But with cardinal numbers, we can say not only is 4 bigger than 2, it's twice as big, or it's 100% bigger. Right? We can talk about degrees of, or, you know, magnitudes. Whereas to say this thing is second best and this thing is fourth best, we know the second best thing is better than the fourth best thing, but we can't say it's twice as better or twice as good. You know, we can't say it's 100% better. That you wouldn't, you know, how would you know? Okay, so that's the Austrian view. They're saying utility is really a preference ranking. And so to say this combination of goods gives you more utility than that combination, all that really means is you get more utility from one versus the other. One, you prefer one to the other. You can't, it doesn't even make sense to say, oh, I get 72% more utils from this versus that, right? Because it's ultimately preferences are a way to understand choice. And so when you choose, when you act in the Misesian sense, you're choosing one thing versus another. So all we could ever really derive from that is that you preferred the one to the other. That's all that your value scales could ever show. And so that's, okay. But guys like David Friedman hear that, like, oh, you guys are idiots. You're not familiar with von Neumann-Morgenstern utility functions. And von Neumann-Morgenstern showed back in the day that if you have uncertainty and you're, and you define these ordinal preference relationships over lotteries defined over the possible outcomes, well, then it's as if you have cardinal utility functions for the specific outcomes. And that the person, and then we can explain a person's activity as if he is maximizing the expectation of that, those cardinal, that cardinal utility function where, you know, if there's an 18% chance of outcome 23 happening, then you do 0.18 times utility, the cardinal utility of outcome 23, plus, you know, 0.5 times the utility of where the outcome ends, if there's a 50% chance of happening like that. And then you choose the lottery that gives you the most expected utility. Okay, especially since we only have 1 minute left, and this is supposed to be a class that conceivably has 7th graders in it who are now in a state of shock. I'm not going to go into the problem with that, but Murray Rothbard picks that apart in his, what's it called, Reconstruction of Value and Utility Theory. I think that's what it's called. All right, so just because you mentioned von Neumann, Joe, that's why I'm bringing it up, that for an Austrian crowd, just be on your guard. And it is mathematically, it's fine as far as it goes. It's kind of a beautiful result that von Neumann and Morgenstern proved this neat little thing about models of behavior and preferences. But the point is, a lot of people erroneously conclude that somehow von Neumann and Morgenstern justified the idea of cardinal utility functions, and no, they didn't. It's the case for believing in cardinal utility is just as strong as it was the day before they published the result, I'll put it that way. So von Neumann, Morgenstern, they did not add to the case for, does it make sense to think utility is cardinal? So if you didn't think it did before you knew about the result, you still shouldn't think it makes sense after the result. Okay, but it's way too complicated to explain why. Okay, thanks guys. And so if you're taking a course for credit, remember I just posted last night the quiz, and quiz 6, and then I'll let the dust settle, and next week I will post the final exam. And remember, if you've never taken one of my courses before, the final is harder than the quiz. The quizzes are just to keep you honest. The quizzes just ask almost throwaway questions that should be no problem if you've watched the lecture. That's usually what it is. I try to force you to watch the lecture to make sure you're watching, and that's what the quiz does. The final, it'll still be multiple choice, but you really will have had to study and some of the questions, even if you read the material, but it was just beyond your grasp, you might get the question wrong because it'll be tricky. So it's not going to be impossible, but don't think, oh, I've been blowing these quizzes out of the water. This final's going to be a breeze. No, the final's trickier. Okay, thanks, everybody. I will not see you next time unless you take another class with me.